to something like this if his life depended on it. Even if he had a chance to score with Allison, which he definitely doesn't. She shudders, emphasizing the pointlessness of Slug's crush on her. I really don't get why he likes her. He keeps saying she looks like a sexy librarian, although I don't understand what's appealing about that, especially to a guy like Slug. We're standing in front of a large bulletin board. There's a giant flyer advertising guitar lessons. I wonder if Daisy would like it if I learned to play the guitar. Don't girls dig stuff like that? I would do just about anything to impress her. Allison swivels her head to follow my gaze. At first, I think she's looking at the guitar flyer, but then she says, "They never found her, did they?" "Who?" I start to ask, but then I notice what she's looking at. It's one of those old missing signs for Brandy Healy, the runaway. "Oh, guess not. How long has it been?" I shrug. "I don't know, 4 or 5 months?" "You knew her, didn't you?" A weird, cold sensation runs down my spine. "Well, yeah. She was in our class at school." Allison's mud-brown eyes are trained on my face. "Right. But you used to tutor her in math, didn't you?" An alarm bell is going off in the back of my head. She's right. Brandy was one of my students until she disappeared. But so what? It's not like anyone blamed me for her running away. I was just the dorky guy helping her pass geometry. The police barely talked to me. I open my mouth, although I'm not sure what I'm going to say. But I get interrupted by Daisy rushing over to us, her pretty face flushed and happy.
"Tom, Allison," she says breathlessly. "You came."
"Of course I came," Allison snips. Despite Allison's attitude, Daisy wraps her arms around her in a warm hug. After she's done hugging Allison, I get hugged next. And our hug lasts longer. A lot longer. Long enough that I'm grateful when Daisy hands me a volunteer apron to cover up the growing tent in my pants.
"So," Daisy says to me, "I've got to find a job for you, Tom. Do you know how to check blood pressures?"
"I don't." "I could learn." She considers this, but then shakes her head.
"Allison, why don't you do the blood pressure checks? I'll have Tom take blood."
"Take what?" When we enter the building, Daisy snatched up my hand in hers and leads me to a middle-aged woman holding a clipboard.
"Hi, Elise," she says to the woman. "I've got a new volunteer to do the diabetic screening."
Elise smiles at me, her pen poised on the clipboard.
"That's wonderful. Who do we have here?" "This is Tom Brewer," she says. "He's my boyfriend."
The smile on my face freezes. Did Daisy just call me her boyfriend? Am I really her boyfriend? Did I actually make the cut? I'm suddenly doing jumping jacks in my head. After Elise signs me in, Daisy leads me over to a table with a sign above that says diabetes screening. There's a set of chairs around the table and a few small blood sugar monitors.
"So what you need to do," she explains in a weirdly stiff voice, "is you use the AccuCheck Lancing device to stick people, and then you put a drop of blood on one of the test strips to find out the blood sugar level."
"No problem," I say. I don't let on how excited I am to embark on this task for the afternoon. I assumed I would be doing something like handing out pamphlets on proper diet and exercise. I never imagined I would be sticking needles into people. I never thought I'd get to do anything like this before medical school. I've got to start volunteering at health fairs more often. She grins at me.
"I figured you could handle it." Allison gets squeamish, but I know you won't.
"Definitely not."
"Perfect. Just don't tell anyone that you're under 18, because technically minors aren't supposed to do blood sugar checks."
It's the first time Daisy has ever suggested doing something immoral like lying. And somehow, it makes me like her even more. And I didn't even know that was possible. I can't stop thinking about her. And when I'm with her, it's almost too much. I like her so much, sometimes I feel like I'm choking.
By the way, I hope what I said before was okay, she adds, her voice hesitant.
What you said?
She shifts between her sneakers.
You know, about you being my boyfriend. I know we never talked about it.
She takes a shaky breath.
I don't know, it popped out. But you don't have to be my boyfriend if you don't want to be. Like, it's no big deal.
No, I say quickly. I want to be your boyfriend. Her blue eyes light up.
Really?
She has no freaking clue.
Really, really.
Daisy looks so happy after I say that. She starts humming to herself as she shows me the package of sensor pads and explains how to load them into the monitor. I watch her carefully, partially because it's hard for me to take my eyes off her, and partially because I need to figure out how to do this thing. After Daisy has shown me everything, she asks,
You got it?
Got it. It's not rocket science or anything. She cocks her head to the side.
Want to practice on me?
My heart speeds up. Sticking a needle into Daisy's finger? Somehow, that doesn't seem like a great idea. I've been doing everything in my power to avoid thinking about stuff like that.
I don't know. Come on. I can't release you on the public without one practice session.
Except, couldn't it be on anyone but Daisy Driscoll? But no, this is happening. Daisy sits down in one of the plastic chairs, and she isn't satisfied until I'm sitting next to her. She places her soft hand on the table, and I can only just barely make out the pulsations of her radial artery in her wrist.
You need to load the lancet in the device, she explains. You can't reuse them, obviously.
Uh-huh. Daisy instructs me as to what to do, but my hands are shaking so badly it takes me about 4 tries to load the lancet. It's embarrassing. She actually starts to laugh.
Why are you shaking so much? Don't you want to be a surgeon?
When I finally get the device loaded, Daisy offers me her index finger. I press the head of the device against the soft pad of her finger. I press the button on the side, and the device jerks as the needle thrusts forward. When I pull it away, a tiny red droplet oozes out of her fingertip.
Is that enough blood? I ask. You may need to squeeze a little more out. I'm not much of a bleeder.
I hold Daisy's finger between mine, kneading out enough blood to fill the sensor pad. I watch in fascination as the crimson dot grows in size. It's amazing how, even though Daisy is the most beautiful girl I've ever seen, her blood looks like everyone else's. The same color, the same consistency. And if she bled out 5 pints, she would be dead like anyone else. Actually, she would probably be dead after even less than 5 pints. Maybe just 3 or 4. I can just imagine the color draining out of her soft cheeks, the way her body would go limp. Well, she would be limp at first, but then she would eventually stiffen in rigor mortis. I've read all about it. Daisy would be so easy to kill. It would barely even be a challenge.
Tom?
Daisy's voice is heavy with concern.
Are you okay? You look really pale.
I'm fine.
You're kind of hurting my finger.
As quickly as I can, I get Daisy's blood on the sensor pad. She pulls her hand away from me, a slightly troubled look on her face. The glucose monitor counts down, analyzing the sample of her blood for the sugar level. 30, 29, 28.
Do you need a Band-Aid?
I ask her. She stares at me for a second, then shakes her head.
I'll do it.
She grabs a Band-Aid from the box on the table and uses her other hand to get it in place. It's a bit of a struggle for her, but when I try to help, she pushes me away. I really messed up. I should have lied and said I knew how to take blood pressure. I would have figured it out. Blood pressure would have been much safer for me.
Are you sure you feel comfortable doing this station, Tom?
She asks me.
I'm comfortable. Are you sure?
I'm sure. The glucose monitor beeps. Daisy's reading is back. 120.
That's normal if they're not fasting, she explains. There's a table of numbers right here that you can refer to. If their blood sugar is high, you just refer them to see their doctor as soon as possible.
Got it. I manage a smile. It was just first-time jitters. I got it, though. I promise.
Daisy looks at me for a long moment, but then her face relaxes. She reaches out to squeeze my arm.
I believe in you.
I wonder if she would still feel the same way if she knew the thoughts that were going through my head as I squeezed the blood out of her finger.
Chapter 14. Present Day. Sydney. Gretchen and I have gone through an entire box of tissues tonight, and a bottle of wine. After each glass of wine, our reminiscing about Bonnie has gotten more and more tearful. Gretchen's eyes and nose are red and puffy, and I'm sure I would look identical if I checked myself in the mirror. It's getting late, but she doesn't seem to want to leave, and I don't want her to leave.
Did you ever see Bonnie practicing smiles? Gretchen asks me.
Practicing smiling?
Yes. She manages her own smile through her tears. I caught her doing it once in the mirror. She told me she liked to practice different smiles for different situations so she didn't look weird to people. Like, she had one smile if she was happy, obviously, and a different smile if she was trying to impress a client, and a different smile if someone was being silly.
Wow, I say. I had no idea. What smile do you think we were getting?
Gretchen looks affronted. The real smile, of course.
Maybe.
Although, there's a part of me that wonders if Bonnie had a side we didn't know about. Even though I got to know her pretty well, there was a part of Bonnie that I could never quite reach. Like, she was in love with Dr. McCarty. She wanted to be exclusive with him, and yet she never even told us his name or introduced him to us. If she had, everything might have been different. Maybe he wouldn't have risked killing her if he knew her friends could identify him. The thought of it makes me tear up all over again.
Oh, hey, Gretchen digs around in her purse. I brought something.
I grab another tissue and dab at my eyes.
What?
Triumphantly, she pulls out two scrunchies. Bonnie left these at my apartment. I thought we could wear them. In her honor, you know? I solemnly accept the scrunchie, lacing my hair through the fabric. Gretchen does the same. Of course, we both look ridiculous. Only Bonnie was able to rock a scrunchie. Gretchen grabs her wine glass off my coffee table, which contains the remainder of the bottle of red wine that had been full this morning. To Bonnie. I tap my own wine glass against hers. To Bonnie. On that note, we both drain the rest of our wine. I wish we had another bottle. I need to keep another in the house, just in case any more of my close friends are murdered in the near future. Gretchen takes a shaky breath. I better get home. It's getting really late. I don't want her to go, but I can't deny that it's close to midnight. I should try to go to bed, but I'm sure I'll just toss and turn. Do you need to call an Uber? She shakes her head. I'm going to spend the night at Randy's apartment. Right. Gretchen doesn't have to spend the night alone like I do. How is he doing? I still have mixed feelings about him, but I have to admit, Randy was a champ this morning. Once I started screaming, he was instantly at my side. I was ready to pass out, but he took charge. He led me into the living room, shutting the door to the bedroom behind him, and then placed a call to 911. I was practically hyperventilating at that point, but Randy was utterly calm. I was grateful at the time, although he must have been shaken. He's okay, Gretchen says. He takes this kind of thing in stride. He takes finding a mutilated dead body in stride? Okay. Anyway, Gretchen rubs at her swollen eyes as she gets to her feet. I'm going to head out, but let's talk tomorrow, okay? As I walk her to the door, All I can think is that I don't want Gretchen to leave. It's late, but I'm sure we can track down another bottle of wine. All I want is for Gretchen to stay in my apartment and reminisce with me more about Bonnie until my eyes finally drift shut. But I can't stop her from going. She gives me a hug at the door, then I watch her make her way down the hallway to the elevator. I keep the door cracked open until she's gone. And now I'm alone. There are times when I love having an apartment all to myself. I've had some pretty bad roommates in the past, and I'm the sort of person who appreciates my solitude. But right now, I hate it. The apartment feels so empty. I feel absolutely and utterly alone. Since the wine is gone, I go into my kitchen and locate the next best thing, a pint of ice cream. I check the flavor, mint chocolate chip. I hate mint chocolate chip. Considering I live alone, I'm not sure why the only ice cream I have in the freezer is a flavor I don't even like. But then I remember that Bonnie brought it over. We were having dinner together. I was the one cooking, and she was responsible for dessert. I gave her a hard time about bringing my least favorite flavor of ice cream, but her response was, "It's ice cream, Sydney. Every flavor is good by definition." Apparently, I'll be wearing a scrunchie and eating mint chocolate chip ice cream in her honor. I plop back down on the couch with my ice cream. It may not be my favorite flavor, but it still tastes pretty damn good. I mean, it's ice cream. You really can't go wrong. As I'm stuffing myself, I reach for my phone. The first thing I do is bring up the Cinch app. This morning, I was looking for the mystery man. That feels like 100 years ago. He is the furthest thing from my mind right now. This time, I type something very specific into the search bar. I type in the name Jacob Souza. And there he is. Chapter 15. If I ever needed confirmation that Jake was still single, now I have it. He's still on Cinch. He's still looking for the one, after we definitively determined that I was not the one. Jake looks good in his photo. It's not a fake photo like Kevin's. It looks more like him than most people's photos do. But that doesn't surprise me. Jake was never the kind of guy who felt like he had something to hide. What you see is what you get. He's dressed in the same shirt and tie he usually wears to work, and he's sporting his perpetual 5 o'clock shadow. I swear, 5 seconds after he shaves, his beard instantly grows back. It also hides some acne scars left over from his teenage years, although it's hard to imagine Jake ever being a skinny teenager. He seems he emerged into the world already 35 years old. I read through the details Jake lists on his profile. Doesn't have kids, wants kids, non-smoker, no political affiliation, favorite hobby, watching football. Well, that's a lie. Jake doesn't have time for hobbies. Under what he's looking for, he wrote, "I want to find a woman I can come home to at the end of a long night of work, enjoy a hot dinner together, and watch a movie on the TV." More lies. Jake doesn't want a woman he can come home to. He doesn't want to come home at all. But despite my simmering resentment, when I look down at his photo, I remember that tug I used to feel when I was with him. We first met through Cinch years ago, after we had both been on a ton of bad dates. And the second I saw him, well, it was that lightning bolt. I knew that I wasn't going on any more bad dates for a long time. Why couldn't it have worked out? Jake and I should be married by now. We should be having children and posting obnoxious baby pictures all over Facebook. I scroll through the contacts on my phone, and sure enough, Jake's name is still there. A smarter woman would have deleted him after we broke up, but I didn't. As long as he hasn't changed his number, I still have it programmed into my phone. Before I can stop myself, I click on his name. The odds seem small that Jake will actually pick up the phone. After all, it's midnight and he's working a case. so I'm surprised when I hear his deep voice on the other end of the line. Well, I'm surprised until I remember that the man never, ever sleeps.
Sydney?
Hey. He doesn't ask me why I'm calling, but the fact that he didn't delete me from his phone says a lot.
Hey.
Despite the fact that I'm just as alone as I was a minute earlier, I feel better now that I've got Jake on the line. He always had a way of making me feel secure. His presence can fill a room, even over the phone. So, how is the case going? I ask him. Did you find that boyfriend?
You know I can't talk to you about that, Sid. It's an ongoing investigation.
Jake was always such a stickler for the rules. Right, I see. He lets out a long sigh.
I can tell you that we haven't made any arrests yet.
Do you have a person of interest? He hesitates.
No.
Great. So the guy who killed Bonnie is still out there while she is lying in the morgue. I don't get it. Don't you guys have all this amazing fingerprint and DNA technology? How is it possible that you don't have the killer in custody?
It's not that simple, Sydney. We have DNA and fingerprints, but no matches in our database.
He pauses.
Well, except for Randall Muncy, but we know he's not our guy.
Great. I had called Jake to get comfort and maybe find out that they caught the bastard who did this. But the revelation that they don't even have any suspects? Well, I'm astonished. How is it possible that they can't track down Bonnie's boyfriend?
Listen, Jake says. Are you still living alone?
I bristle. Excuse me?
No, I mean...
He clears his throat.
You should just be careful. Make sure you lock your door. Do you have a deadbolt?
Yes.
Well, use it. Are you still on cinch?
Yes.
Think you could take a break from it for a while?
I grit my teeth. One of my best friends was murdered last night. I'm not exactly thinking about my next date.
Okay, well, good.
This talk is making me uneasy. Is there a reason that I should be worried, Jake? He's quiet for a long time, and if he were sitting beside me, I would want to wring his neck.
Okay, he finally says. I'm going to tell you something that we haven't leaked to the press yet, but I think you should know.
Know what?
You swear this is just between us?
Yes!
I wasn't being entirely honest with you before.
Jake takes a breath.
We actually do have a fingerprint match.
I suck in a breath. That's great! That means they must be close to making some sort of arrest. So how come you haven't arrested the guy?
Because we don't know whose fingerprints they are.
I frown. I don't understand. What do they match with, then?
Another crime scene.
My stomach sinks as I absorb what he is trying to tell me. The fingerprints in Bonnie's apartment matched fingerprints found at another crime scene. Does that mean...
It was another woman about Bonnie's age, he says. Looked sort of like her, too. And there were other details that were similar, like what was done to the body before and after death.
I overheard one of the police officers saying that they thought Bonnie was tortured before she was actually killed. It's the kind of thing that's very hard to get out of your head. Something in particular that was similar? I ask.
Yes,
he confirms.
But you have to swear you won't tell a soul, Sid. This is not public information, but you deserve to know.
The way he's saying it, I'm not even sure I want to know anymore. And yet, I won't be able to sleep tonight if he doesn't tell me. What is it?
Both women. They had a large chunk of hair snipped from their heads, very close to the scalp, at exactly the same spot. And we couldn't find the hair anywhere in the apartments. So it seems like the killer may have taken it. As a souvenir.
And now I'm imagining some lunatic storing Bonnie's hair in a jar in his basement.
The other victim also dated a lot of men on cinch. Jake says. They were able to locate several of her recent dates and eliminate them as suspects. But there were fingerprints in the apartment, as well as DNA that could not be identified. When was this?
About 18 months ago.
Bonnie told me she had started dating that guy about a year ago. So apparently, he murdered a woman, took a break for 6 months, then found his next victim. My head is spinning, and it's not from the wine. I'm sorry I ate all that mint chocolate chip ice cream, because I feel like I'm going to throw it all up.
Sydney, Jake says firmly, we are going to find this guy. I promise you that.
You haven't found him yet.
Look, if this wasn't a crime of passion, it might take more time.
I can envision that sexy crease he gets between his dark eyebrows.
A serial killer who planned this in advance would have covered his tracks better. He was obviously careful not to be seen with her publicly, or allow himself to appear on social media with her. Who knows if she even knew his real name? But don't worry, we will find him, sooner or later.
I'm not sure I believe him, but what choice do I have? It's not like I have any control over this case. But I do think that if they truly believe there's a serial killer roaming the city targeting young women, they are going to do everything in their power to find him.
Sid,
he says,
are you okay?
I look over at my empty bottle of wine, empty tissue box, and melting ice cream. I've been better.
Do you want me to come over?
My face burns. Are you asking for a booty call?
No, Christ, no.
He sounds flustered in a way I used to find very endearing.
I just thought maybe tonight you wouldn't want to be alone. And I could, you know, be there. On your couch, obviously, if you want.
Don't you need to get some sleep?
Sleep? What's that?
Despite everything, I let out a snorting laugh. Jake did seem to exist on only a couple of hours of sleep every night. It's fine, I say. My friend Gretchen was here all night, and now I'm going to sleep. Besides, it would be weird if you came over.
I wouldn't let it be weird.
I don't know if you have any control over it. I let out a yawn. Anyway, I guess I'll attempt to go to sleep now.
Okay,
Jake says.
Just make sure you throw that deadbolt.
Jesus, I mutter. Don't worry so much. Nobody is going to break into my house tonight and murder me. That seems really unlikely.
Just do it.
Yes, Mom, I grunt. Anyway, good night. Thanks for the terrifying update.
Good night, Sid.
We hang up, and for a moment, all I can do is sit there, staring at the black screen of my phone. And then I get off the couch, walk over to the front door, and make sure the deadbolt is in place.
Chapter 16. Before. Tom. I wake up covered in sweat. I was dreaming about Daisy. Again. Every other night I dream about her. And every time, I wake up with my heart pounding and my bed sheets soaked. In this dream, Daisy and I were in the kitchen together, cooking. I used to love cooking with my mom when I was a little kid, and I still enjoy it, even though my father says cooking is women's work. I learned how to sharpen knives using the rim of a ceramic mug, so all the knives in our kitchen are very sharp. Too sharp. Daisy was slicing some green beans when she let out a yelp. In real life, all she could have possibly done was nick the tip of her finger. But in my dream, she had managed to somehow slice off her entire hand. The severed hand lay on the table, the fingers twitching. And Daisy looked up at me with her liquid blue eyes. I had an accident, Tom. What should I do? I asked helplessly, as I watched the blood gush from the stump of her left arm. Well, Daisy said, now I am uneven, so you'll have to cut off the other hand so I'll be symmetrical again. Even in my dreamlike state, I recognized this wasn't a good idea. But I obligingly took the carving knife out of the knife block while Daisy lay her right hand down on the kitchen counter. I held the knife over my head and brought it down hard on her right forearm. It sliced cleanly through the bone, severing her right hand. That's when I woke up. About 3 or 4 times a week, I have a dream in which I am stabbing or strangling my beautiful girlfriend. On 2 occasions, I imagine myself holding her underwater until she drowned. And every time I wake up, I feel a rush of relief. I didn't do it. I didn't hurt her. Daisy is okay. My relief tonight lasts only a few seconds, though. That's how long it takes to realize what woke me up. It's the sound of screaming. My mother is screaming. I jump out of bed, not bothering to throw on any clothes, so I'm just in my white undershirt and boxers. I haven't heard her scream like this in a long time. For a while, when I was a little kid, it used to happen all the time. My mother instructed me not to leave my room if I heard scary noises. "Hide in the closet, Tommy," she told me. "Promise me you won't come out until I say so." When I get downstairs, I realize the noises are coming from the kitchen. The sound of my father's booming voice echoes through the house.
"It's none of your damn business what I do when I go out," he shouts at her. "Your job is to look pretty and have dinner on the table every night, and you're doing a shitty job at both."
Something else shatters in the kitchen. He's throwing more dishes at her. My body fills with red-hot rage. He can't talk to my mother that way. Maybe when I was a kid, he could get away with it, but not anymore. Except he's still bigger than me. I've got to even things out. I need a weapon. Most things in this house that could serve as a weapon are in the kitchen, and he is in there. I look around the living room, and my eyes fall on the fire poker leaning against the fireplace. The end of that poker is sharp enough to tear through skin. I imagine sinking it deep into my father's chest. Yes, that will do. I march into the kitchen, gripping the fire poker in my right hand. My mother is curled up on the floor, clutching her face as she sobs into her hands, and my father is standing over her, reeking of whiskey. I arrive just in time for him to hurl a ceramic mug at her head, which shatters about an inch away from her face as she screams again. "Hey!" I growl at him. "Leave her alone!" Even though I spoke, it takes my father a moment to realize I'm in the room. And when he sees me, he smirks at my underwear.
"Go to bed, kid," he says.
He never calls me by my name. It's always kid or boy. Well, tonight he's going to find out that I'm not a kid anymore. "Leave her alone," I raise the fire poker threateningly, "or else." My father looks me up and down. He stares at the sharp end of the fire poker in my right hand, and after a few seconds, he bursts out laughing. He looks over at my mother.
"You believe this kid of yours, Luann? Threatening me with a fire poker?"
My mom raises her face from her hands. I can't tell if her eyes are swollen from crying or because he hit her.
"Tommy, please don't get involved. Go back to your room."
"Listen to your mother, boy," he says. "Get back to your room and mind your own goddamn business."
"No, I'm not going." My eyes meet his. I look a lot more like my mother. I've got her nose and chin and build, but he and I have the same eyes. Very, very dark and laser beam focused on what we want. In 2 quick strides, my father crosses the kitchen. For a moment, he's close enough for me to strike. I could shove the sharp point of the fire poker through his beer belly and it would all be over. He would never hurt my mother again. But I hesitate. He's my father, after all. Could I really do that? That hesitation is all it takes. He reaches out and snatches the poker right out of my hands before I can stop him.
"So, Tom,"
his dark eyes stay trained on mine,
"what were you saying?"
I can't believe it. How did I let this get turned around on me? My mother, previously cowering on the floor, scrambles to her feet and dashes across the kitchen.
"Don't you dare hurt him, Bill!"
He easily shoves her out of the way, like she's a rag doll. Her body crashes back to the floor, and her head hits the side of the stove with a sickening thud. The blow is not enough to knock her out, but it's taken all the fight out of her. And now it's just me and my father, the fire poker gripped in his right hand.
"Listen to me, kid."
His voice is low and menacing.
"What happens between me and your mom? That's none of your business. You get me?"
I don't answer him. He lifts the fire poker and jabs the tip into my belly. It's not enough to break the skin, but it tears my undershirt, and I gasp with pain. "Bill!" My mother sobs from the floor. "Please stop! Please!" He whips his head around.
"Shut up, Luann, or else I swear to God I will shove this poker right through his gut."
He would do it. He's drunk enough and he's mean enough, and there's no way I could wrestle that poker back out of his hands. One good jab and the point will pass through my skin and impale my intestines. It will be a terrible way to die.
"You gonna leave us alone from now on, boy?" my father growls.
When I don't answer, he jabs me harder. The sharp point slices through my skin, and the white of my torn undershirt rapidly turns red with my blood. The pain is intense enough to make my knees wobble. My mother is sobbing and pleading for him not to hurt me, but she doesn't move. She knows she can't help me. Part of me wants him to do it. Let him kill me, then spend the rest of his life in jail so my mother is safe. But a much larger part of me doesn't want to die. There's too much I want to do with my life. I want to become a surgeon. I want to lose my virginity to Daisy Driscoll. And someday, I want to marry her. I'm not sure if all that is possible for me, but I know what I don't want. I don't want to die in the kitchen of this crappy, run-down house at my father's hands. "Fine," I croak. I hold up my hands. "Whatever you say." He sniffs loudly.
"And what are you going to do if you hear any sound in the middle of the night? You gonna mind your own business?"
"Yes," I say through my teeth.
"What? I didn't hear that too good. Yes!"
Satisfied, my father lowers the fire poker. The sharp pain vanishes, replaced with a dull ache. The bottom half of my undershirt is damp with my blood. I've got to get this cleaned up before I go back to bed. I don't want to get blood all over the sheets.
"Get out of here, boy!"
my father snaps at me. I really, really don't want to leave my mother alone. But she's pleading with me with her eyes, so I do like he tells me. But this isn't over. One of these days, he's going to go too far and kill her. I'm not going to let that happen.
Chapter 17. Present Day. Sydney. Bonnie's funeral is today. It's being held at a church in Brooklyn, which is where her parents live. It's ironic, because I'm fairly sure that in the time I knew Bonnie, she never once set foot in a church. It's not that she wasn't religious exactly, but, well, she wasn't religious. But she wasn't anti-religion. She wouldn't be offended by the fact that her funeral was being held in a church, especially if that's what her parents wanted. The part that might be more offensive to her is that she requires a funeral at 33 years old. Gretchen, Randy, and I are stuffed into a yellow cab, riding out to Bensonhurst, the smell of hot leather seats heavy in the air. Randy wanted to take the D train instead of a taxi, but I didn't feel like dealing with the subway in my fancy funeral attire. And what if something happened and we didn't get there on time? Bonnie was such a stickler for promptness, she would have haunted us for at least the next year if we were late. "Did you bring tissues?" I asked Gretchen, who is squeezed into the back seat between me and Randy. "Loads," she confirms.
"Why do you need so many tissues?" Randy speaks up. "Is there going to be food?"
Randy is wearing a navy blue suit that can vaguely pass for black. He looks like he made some attempt to comb his usually unruly dark brown hair, but since he has had the window cracked open for the entire cab ride,
all his hard work has been undone by the wind. We are going to a funeral, I remind him. When he looks at me blankly, I add, it's sad.
Right, but he frowns. I mean, you guys were just friends. It's not like she was your sister or your mother.
I can only stare at Randy in astonishment. He's not even trying to be a jerk. He is legitimately confused as to why we would be sad over Bonnie's death. Thankfully, before I can say anything I regret, Gretchen elbows him in the ribs. You're an idiot, she says.
Well said.
The church is a gigantic structure that seems to take up half the city block. My gaze sweeps over the steeple, which has a cross mounted on top. The taxi pulls up in front of what looks like an endless staircase to enter the church. Before I can reach for my purse, Randy hands a wad of bills over to the driver.
It's on me, he tells us. It's your friend's funeral, and you guys are sad.
I feel a little guilty because I don't think Randy makes that much money as the super, but I've learned to be gracious when people offer to pay. I climb out of the taxi, and Gretchen is a step behind me. She is tugging on the black skirt that shows off her skinny yet shapely legs. Ah, she says. Do you think this skirt is inappropriately short for a funeral? It's fine, I say, even though I secretly think it's a little too short. But what is she supposed to do? She can't exactly go home and change. I'm about to follow Randy and Gretchen up the tower of stairs to the front door when I see a man leaning against the side of the church. My stomach flips slightly at the sight of Detective Jake Souza. I tell my friends to go on ahead and save me a seat. And then I approach Jake, my purse clutched protectively to my chest. Jake saw me a second after I noticed him. He offers me a grim smile.
My condolences, he says.
I don't want his condolences. I only care about one thing. Have you arrested anyone yet? He hangs his head.
Unfortunately, no.
I can't believe this. It's been a week since Bonnie's murder, and with every passing day, it's less and less likely that they will ever arrest anyone. Did you ever find her boyfriend? He shakes his head.
That's why I'm here. I'm kind of hoping he might show up.
You think he's that dumb?
Murderers often visit the funerals of their victims. Several have been caught under those circumstances.
Wow, I sneer. You must be super desperate. Jake drops his eyes.
Look, I'm sorry. I wish I had better news for you. You don't know how many hours I have put in trying to find this bastard. We don't even know if the boyfriend is the one who killed her. Maybe it's somebody completely different.
Frustration is written all over his face. When we were dating, Jake had an amazing success rate in solving homicides. If I were murdered, he would be the detective I would want on the case. And I truly believe that if he can't find the person who killed Bonnie, nobody can. But maybe nobody can. Which is a very depressing thought. And a terrifying one.
You're still deadbolting your door at night, right?
Jake asks me. Yes, I confirm. But don't worry, I'm not dating anyone. He looks like he isn't sure what to make of that statement. Jake is this big, muscular detective who never seems to lose his cool, and it always used to amuse me to make him squirm just a little bit. I can't help but think of Jake's profile on Cinch. He may have acted like he was too busy for a significant other, but he is still looking. He's still hoping to find his other half, even if he can't give her what she wants.
If you see anything suspicious at the funeral, he says, will you let me know?
I will. He frowns at me, his lips pressed together.
Be careful, Sid.
Yeah, as if I'm not terrified enough without him saying that. When I get inside the church, I notice a woman in her 60s standing in the back, wearing a black blazer and skirt, her eyes puffy and the whites almost painfully bloodshot. I recognize her as Bonnie's mother. I get a pang just looking at her. As awful as this is for me, it's got to be a million times worse for her. She is in a conversation with someone else, but then our eyes lock. She murmurs, "Excuse me," to the person she's talking to, and hurries over to me. I instinctively flinch. It's not that I don't want to talk to Mrs. Griffin, but just looking at her makes me horribly sad.
"Is it Sydney?"
she asks.
"Yes," I nod. I'm so sorry, Mrs. Griffin."
"Thank you."
Tears flow from her already moist eyes. "I miss her so much, it hurts my soul."
"I'm so sorry," I say again, because I really just don't know what else to say.
"You were a good friend to her, though, Sydney. I really appreciate that."
"Thank you. She was a good friend to me, too. I'll miss her so much."
She dabs her eyes with a tissue that has seen better days. She didn't even bother with mascara, which was a wise choice.
"The police told me she was seeing a man regularly. Do you have any idea who it was?"
"She did tell me she was seeing someone, but that's all I know."
She didn't mention his name? Show you a photo?"
"I'm sorry, no."
"But how could that be?" she bursts out. "You girls talk all the time, and you all are constantly taking photos of every little stupid thing. Bonnie once sent me 5 pictures of a piece of sushi. How is it possible that there was not one photograph on her phone of this man that she was dating?"
I take a step back.
I don't know."
"You must know something."
The tears are flowing freely now.
"Please, Sydney, you've got to remember something about this man. You can't just let him get away with killing my baby." If it had been you," she snaps at me, "Bonnie would have done everything she could to find out who did this to you. She wouldn't just shrug her shoulders and tell your mother that she's sorry."
Mrs. Griffin is practically hysterical now. Thankfully, one of her friends or relatives comes over, puts an arm around her shoulder, and leads her away from me. Although, by this point, I am shaking like a leaf. The worst part is, she's right. I still remember the way Bonnie threatened real Kevin to get him away from me. If our situations were reversed, she would not give up so easily. I've done nothing to help catch the monster who did this to her. If only I could go back in time, I would ask her more questions about the guy. What was his name? Can I see a photograph? Where does he work? Of course, the answers may have been lies anyway, but at least it would have been something. My legs can barely support me as I make my way to where Gretchen and Randy have found seats near the front of the church. I have to squeeze down the aisle to sit next to them, and Gretchen has started crying again.
"I saw Bonnie's mother shouting at you," Gretchen says. "Are you okay?"
"Yes," I lie. "She's just devastated, that's all."
"Of course she's devastated," Gretchen sniffles. "It's all so awful."
For a moment, I imagine my mother in the church at my funeral, sobbing hysterically like she did when my dad died. The murder of your child is the kind of thing you never recover from. Gretchen and I will eventually move on, but Mrs. Griffin won't. Not ever. Randy reaches out and laces his fingers through Gretchen's. She flashes him a grateful smile, which makes me feel even more sad that I don't have anyone to hold hands with. And maybe I never will. After all, my dates recently have been bad and worse. And now I'm terrified to even use Cinch. I look behind me at the back of the church to see if Jake has entered. At least he's a comforting presence, even if things didn't work out between the two of us. But instead of Jake, I see something that completely shocks me. It's Kevin. Kevin is at Bonnie's funeral. Chapter 18. What is real Kevin doing at Bonnie's funeral? Jake told me to be on the lookout for something suspicious, and Bonnie's mother practically accosted me for details about her murder. I have to say, seeing the man Bonnie threatened sitting in the back of the church is the most suspicious thing I have seen since discovering Bonnie's body. Except, is that really him? I'm not entirely certain.
He's all the way across the nave, and the church is surprisingly dark. So it's possible I could be wrong. Entirely possible. I crane my neck, trying to get a better look, but I'm interrupted by the doors of the church opening. It's the pallbearers, carrying Bonnie's casket. There's no way I can keep from staring at the oak wood coffin making its way to the front of the church. Considering that only a couple of weeks ago, Bonnie and I were doing tree pose and enjoying chai lattes together, it seems impossible that she is now in that box for all eternity. I recognize one of the pallbearers as her brother, and he is just barely keeping it together. They lay the coffin in its resting spot, although she will later be buried in a local cemetery. It's a closed casket because of what was done to Bonnie, but she wouldn't have minded. She once told me she thought it was creepy when people had open caskets. Who wants to look at a dead person? I would have liked to see her one more time, though. I would have liked to confirm she will be wearing her favorite pair of black pumps, and that whoever dressed her made sure to put a scrunchie in her hair. That is what she would have wanted. As the priest addresses us, I can't stop staring at the coffin. I can't believe Bonnie is dead and that her body is in that box. How is that possible? How could she be dead? She was so young, and there was so much that she wanted to do with her life. She used to talk about taking time off from work to take a trip to Latin America and just spend a year there, bouncing from country to country. She imagined saving up enough money to buy a house on the beach. She had never learned to play an instrument, and she said that one of these days she was definitely going to learn to play the guitar. When my life isn't so busy. But one thing that was really important to her was finding her other half. She didn't enjoy going on dates every single night. She did it because she was searching for love. She wanted someone to spend her life with. Now, none of that will ever happen. She will never fall in love. She will never play the guitar. She will never have a house on the beach. Instead, she's going to spend the rest of eternity buried in the ground. The thought of it makes me feel like I'm going to start hyperventilating. I clutch my knees, trying to suck in deep breaths. This is okay. I'm going to be okay. I'm not going to end up dead in my early 30s like Bonnie. Gretchen notices me freaking out, and she rubs her hand against my back. You okay? She whispers. Uh-huh, I manage. Gretchen rubs circles on my back while I struggle to get my breathing under control. But it's hard. I just keep thinking about Bonnie in that coffin. Dead. Forever. Rotting in the ground. That won't be me. I won't let it be. Never.
Chapter 19. Before. Tom.
When I get to school, there are two police cars parked right in front. I almost do an about-face and go home. The presence of multiple police cars can't possibly mean anything good. I rub my abdomen, which has healed up for the most part since my father nearly impaled me with a fire poker. Slug is leaning against the school, hastily stubbing out a cigarette with his sneaker at the sight of the police chief. Although they look like they couldn't care less about a couple of teenagers with cigarettes. Hey, Slug. I jog over to my best friend, knowing he will for sure know exactly what's going on. He always does. What's up with the cop cars? A grin spreads across Slug's face. He has an angry-looking pimple right at the corner of his lips.
You didn't hear? They found Brandy Healy.
Oh? You mean she came back home?
No, they found her body.
He laughs at the look on my face.
Guess she didn't run away after all.
I feel like I'm going to choke. They found Brandy. That means she was buried out in the woods only about half an hour from here, he says. Because of all the snow during the winter, nobody found her. Apparently, some lady was walking her dog, and the dog dug up the body.
I lean against the wall of the school, wishing for once that I smoked like Slug.
because a cigarette really seems like it would be great right now.
That's terrible.
Slug nods.
And I overheard that they think whoever did this to her tortured her before they killed her. Like, they really made her suffer.
Jesus.
Some people are really sick,
Slug says, although his voice is almost gleeful.
Hey, you knew her pretty well, didn't you, Tom?
I take a big gulp of air.
Not really. Yeah, you did. You tutored her, didn't you?
Barely. She didn't even show up half the time.
Man, Slug shakes his head. If I had been tutoring that girl, I wouldn't have been able to keep my hands off her. She was hot, you know?
He laughs.
Not so much anymore, though.
My hands ball into fists. I don't like the way he's talking about Brandy.
Don't talk about her that way.
He looks at me in surprise.
What's your problem, Tom?
I shake my head. I don't want to talk about Brandy at all anymore. Although I have a bad feeling, that's all anybody is going to be talking about today. And if anybody finds out that I...
Tom!
It's Daisy's voice. She is running toward me, her face streaked with tears. Before I know what's happening, she hurls herself into my arms, clinging to me. I push all the dark thoughts from my head and focus on comforting Daisy.
It's so awful, Daisy murmurs. What they did to Brandy.
Naturally, Allison is following close behind. While I've got Daisy in my arms and I'm stroking her golden hair, Allison is staring at me. It's hard to read her expression exactly, but her narrow lips are a straight line. The other day, at the health fair, she brought up the fact that I used to tutor Brandy. But that's no secret, and it's not a big deal.
My father said he's going to find out who did this to her.
Daisy sniffles into my t-shirt.
Do they have any suspects?
Slug asks. Allison won't quit staring at me, and it's making my skin crawl.
Daisy, didn't you say your father told you he's pretty sure the killer was a student at the school?
That's what he said, Daisy confirms. That's why the police are going to be asking everyone if they know anything.
The thought of being interrogated by a police officer makes me want to throw up. And if he doesn't like what I have to say...
Will you walk me home today, Tom?
Daisy asks softly.
I know you're tutoring, but...
I'll cancel it.
Really?
I nod. The kid I'm tutoring today would just as soon skip out on it anyway. His mom is the one who pays me. And who knows? By the time the last bell rings, I could very well be getting marched out of the school in handcuffs.
Chapter 20. Before. Tom.
Apparently, I'm pretty low down on the list of people who knew Brandy Healy. I spend the entire morning at school listening to names called out over the loudspeaker. The first 20 names or so are Brandy's friends. She sure had a lot of them. And then some of the guys in our class who were spotted in a lip lock with Brandy at one time or another. By the time I hear the name Thomas Brewer called over the loudspeaker, it's late morning, and I've worked myself into a complete panic. I'm so freaked out that I can barely manage to get out of my seat, and I nearly trip over my own 2 feet on the way to the door.
Are you okay, Tom?
Mrs. Anthony, our English teacher, asks me. Before I can answer, a kid in the back of the room blurts out,
He's just scared Daisy will think he was dating Brandy on the side.
And then a bunch of assholes next to him start laughing. If they think it's funny to joke about it, that means nobody thinks I was dating her. So maybe I'm working myself up over nothing. Between the door of my third-floor English classroom and the principal's office on the first floor, I almost manage to convince myself that I have nothing to be worried about. I practice a confident, easy smile that I plan to use when I talk to the police officer. This is not a big deal. They've already talked to at least 24 kids. I'm just one of many. But then when I see Chief Driscoll sitting in the principal's office, his large body stuffed into the wooden chair, all my confidence flies out the window. I had no idea Daisy's father was going to be the one questioning me. As much as I'm intimidated by my father,
I'm much more terrified of the police, Chief. Being interrogated by Chief Driscoll is my worst nightmare. No, he's not interrogating me. He's just going to ask a few questions. I need to calm down. Calm down, for Christ's sake, Tom! Chief Driscoll smiles when he sees me in the doorway. Instinctively, I freeze, and he waves a large hand to usher me into the room. He points at the small wooden chair in front of the principal's desk.
Hi, Tom, he booms. Have a seat.
I don't so much as sit in the chair as I collapse into it, my legs unable to hold me up. Hello, sir, I say, keeping my voice slow and respectful.
Now, Tom.
The smile vanishes from his face, and his expression turns grim.
Do you know why we called you in here?
I heard about Brandy.
He nods. Terrible stuff. Truly terrible. And we need to catch the monster who did this to her.
Right, of course.
So.
He rubs his big, thick hands together. My own hands are covered in sweat.
I hear you used to tutor Brandy in math.
Yes, just for a few months. And honestly, she skipped a lot of the sessions. That's not entirely true. Brandy never skipped our sessions. I don't want to miss out on seeing you, Tom.
How well did you know her? The chief asks.
Not very well.
Uh-huh.
He rubs at the slight stubble on his chin, even though I suspect he shaved this morning.
Do you know if she had a boyfriend?
A boyfriend? One corner of his lips quirks up.
She told some of her close friends that she had a crush on a boy in your class, but she didn't say who it was. It sounded like he liked her, too. And according to a couple of her friends, she and the boy had plans to meet the night she disappeared. But like I said, we don't know who it was.
I fight to keep my voice even. I have no idea, sir. I was just the dorky kid tutoring her in math. It's not like she would have confided in me.
Right. I guess not.
He sighs and leans back in his chair, which lets out a scary-sounding groan.
Such a terrible thing about Brandy. Makes me want to keep Daisy under lock and key.
I nod, trying to look sympathetic.
Of course, I trust you, Tom.
He manages a smile.
I said to Helen last night, thank God Daisy is with Tom and not one of those other wild boys. He's one of the good ones.
I try to swallow, but it feels like my throat is closed off. Thank you, sir.
When are you coming over for dinner, by the way? He asks. My wife keeps asking me.
The dinner invitation calms me down. If he suspected me of anything, he wouldn't be inviting me to his house for dinner. Or would he? I don't know for sure, but he definitely wouldn't be okay with me hanging out with his only daughter. I'm safe. For now. But if he finds out... Let me ask my mother if it's okay, I say. But, yeah, that would be great. I will never, ever come to his house for dinner.
Chapter 21. Present day. Sydney. By the end of Bonnie's funeral, Gretchen and I have used up all the tissues we brought. But on the plus side, I feel so emotionally drained that my panic attack has subsided. People start filtering out of the church, and it's only then that I remember spotting real Kevin in the back. I got so emotional when that casket came out, I forgot all about it. I swivel my head, thinking I can get a better look now, but... Wait, where is he? He was sitting in the back row. I saw him there, right at the end of the row. Except I don't see him anymore. In the place where he was sitting, there's now an elderly man. What are you looking at? Gretchen asks me. I don't know quite how to explain this to her. Do you remember that guy who I went on that horrible date with? The one who attacked me? Yes? Well, he was here. At the funeral. Really? Her eyes widen. Where? He was here, I correct myself.
but I don't see him anymore. I guess he left. What should we do? She grabs my arm. Should we call the police? Jake might still be here, but I feel stupid telling him about this. The more I think about it, the less certain I feel that it really was Kevin. I'm still so freaked out about our encounters that I may have let my imagination run wild. It's not like I'm thinking straight right now. Anyway, I'm not even sure I know Kevin's real name. I have no extra useful information. No, I already told Jake about Kevin, and I'll leave it to him to investigate. Never mind, I mutter. Are you sure? I nod. Yeah, I probably got it wrong. But even after I convince myself that it wasn't real Kevin at the funeral, I can't shake my sense of uneasiness. But I can't let this get to me. I need to take Jake's advice. I will keep locking my deadbolt every night and stay off Cinch. And hopefully he'll catch the monster who did this to Bonnie. And then life will go on. Chapter 22. 2 months later. Sydney. I am having the best freaking date ever. For the month after Bonnie died, I was afraid of my own shadow, definitely too scared to jump back into the dating pool, especially since Jake and the rest of the NYPD never made an arrest for her murder. That part infuriated me more than anything. At first, I was calling him every few days, asking for updates, and I berated him when there never were any. I vowed that I would not go on another date until they found out who did that to Bonnie. But then, one day I was eating dinner on my sofa in front of the TV, wearing my usual uniform of a t-shirt and sweatpants, and it hit me that in exactly 6 months I was going to be 35 years old. My life was slipping away, and after nearly 2 straight months of feeling sad about Bonnie, I decided it was enough. It was time to move on. I reactivated my Cinch profile the next day. And I'm glad I did, because I am having a great time on this date. His name is Travis, and he looks exactly like his photo. He has reddish-brown hair, a square jaw, and tight muscles in his forearms. And he's a perfect 6 inches taller than I am. And even better, he seems nice. We have things in common. We like the same movies. Not Rocky. We have the same sense of humor. And best of all, he hasn't made me FaceTime his mother once in the entire time we've been having coffee together. I have to tell you, Sydney, he says as he sips on his cup of coffee. This is the best date I've had in a long time. Me too, I agree. We are having a coffee date at this pretentious little coffee shop that is packed because it recently got written up in the New York Times. I suggested coffee so I wouldn't be stuck with him if we didn't connect. But we have now ordered 2 blueberry muffins, 1 white chocolate and raspberry scone, and also something called a cronut. It's not quite a croissant and not quite a donut, but it definitely has 1,000,000 calories. We have completely spoiled our dinners because we just don't want to leave. Honestly, he says, I was ready to give up. I have been on some doozies lately. Tell me about it, I giggle. I could tell you stories that would blow your mind. I bet I could top you. I'm not so sure. He grins at me, and I grin back. I don't want to get carried away, but I think this is going somewhere. I really think there's going to be a second date, then a third, and maybe a lot more after that. And then, out of the corner of my eye, the door to the coffee shop swings open. A man walks in, and I almost do a double take when I recognize